When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. There are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. Gaia.com. G-A-I-A.com.
Everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. It's me, y'all. It's me. It's Cam Hale. And joining me, as always, sitting over here in the chair, pounding away on the keyboard. I'm not sure what he was up to. It's me, amigo, Mr. Filio, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm super duper excited about being here today. I just don't know what to think. The Cubs are actually in the World Series. I've been a big fan for a long time. I know that there's others out there that have been fans way longer than me. That don't want to hear what I'm saying, but I am surprised. It's really awkward knowing that the Cubs are actually in the World Series. It's the first time I've ever been able to see that or say that. They haven't even been in a World Series for 71 years, and they haven't won a World Series since 1908. So for all you people in England that don't know what I'm talking about, it's a baseball team that I'm really passionate about, and it's exciting to finally see them do good because they've been such garbage for so long. In fact, I was watching the game where they beat the Dodgers just last night, and they showed a man. He was old. He was like 80. He was like in his 80s, 81 or so. And he probably was 80 exactly, if it makes sense with the story. He's 80 years old, and he said when he was a little boy, he was about 9 years old, and this was the last time the Cubs were in the World Series. And his dad went and got tickets and took his two older brothers, but not him. He said, no, you're too young or whatever. I'll take you to the next game. I only got this amount of tickets. So he had to stay home that game. Well, the Cubs lost. They've never been back till now. He was at that game. He's like, I've been waiting 71 years for that next game. Wow. And he was there. So, I mean, when you see that, you're like, man, that is crazy.
I heard that Bob Newhart is all excited about it, too, because that's what he said. He's like, I was a little boy. Because Newhart's 87.
Yeah.
And he's like, I was a child when they went to the last one. And he's like, I can't wait to just see them at this one again. Win, lose, or draw, baby. I'm so happy that they're going.
Yeah.
But I hope they have to win.
They have to, right?
They'll burn Chicago to the ground if they win. I mean, I hope they win, and I hope they win it in Wrigley.
Me too. Yeah.
That's the way that needs to go. That's how the story needs to play out and everything line out. I got you something, Brud.
Yeah.
Enough with the baseball chit chat. I got you something interesting. This comes, of course, from the Sydney Morning Herald, folks. I'm a big fan of Tasmanian Devils. I didn't really know much about them until our amigo over there with the Thylacine Research Unit, Mr. Chris Copeland, all the work that he does with them. I've been keeping up with stuff all the time on his Facebook page, and then it's got me reading things about them, and they're extremely interesting little creatures. Well, apparently, I guess whenever Chris isn't hunting for thylacine, he gets them up early in the morning and he gets them up in the pen and he puts little milking machines on them. I'm kidding. I don't really know. But this is actually something that's going down, folks. It says devil's milk could be the killer ingredient in war on superbugs. It says it's proved to be an unlikely weapon in the increasingly desperate global fight against superbugs. Australian researchers have discovered that peptides contained in the milk of Tasmanian devils can kill some of the most deadly bacterial and fungal infections, including golden staph. It says that they've scanned the devil's genome and discovered the six naturally occurring antimicrobial peptides, and researchers from Sydney University set about replacing them artificially. And it says that there's unbelievably effective at killing these harmful bacteria that are known to human beings.
That's cool.
Isn't that insane?
Who would ever think that?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you who it was. A PhD candidate, Emma Peel, she thought that. She said it was really exciting. Apparently, she's been working on this. It says, given the marsupial delivers under highly developed young, you know, when they come out in 21 days gestation. Wow. Says there was some expectation that mother's milk would play a role in the development of the Joey's immune system after birth. However, Ms. Peel, a biologist, said that they weren't expecting what they found. She said this, we showed that these devil peptides kill multi-drug-resistant bacteria, which to her is really cool. And then it talks about staph, of how it can kill golden staph, and even the methicillin resistance. It can, all this, I guess what you're talking about is the crazy, the golden staph, I guess, is like the wildest of the staph.
It's definitely a cool name.
And fatal. Yeah. Yeah. And they're talking about fatal bacteria. Not wipes them out. All this stuff. Nah, devil's milk. No, I don't think so. She goes on to say that this vancomycin is a pretty potent antibiotic. And if a bug is resistant to that, then there aren't a lot of drug options available for you that she's talking about. But apparently, it says 3 years in the making, the results published in scientific reports, the parts of the Natural Journal, could inspire the development of new drugs that would prove crucial in the global balance battle, basically, against this stuff.
Tasmanian devil milk.
Tasmanian devil
milk. Is it because they're so ornery? I mean, if that's the case, somebody needs to go and test a honey badger's milk. It might be able to cure cancer with that shit.
You with the ornery. I love the whole lot. Mama says alligators is so ornery because they got all those teeth and no toothbrush.
Yeah.
The whole idea of this, because who would have ever thought it? No, really and truly. You're like, but it makes sense. This, the baby devils go from 21 days gestation, they're ready to rock and roll. So you've got to be juicing them up with something. Well, you're juicing them up with some good milk.
Super hormones.
Some super milk that you're giving them. I always think back of it. Is it, what is the Rob Schneider movie? The Animal. Remember, he's like, that's some good badger milk. He's got that and it goes bad on his front porch. He's drinking that clabbered badger milk.
Yeah.
That's what it makes me think of. But anyhow, I'm all pumped up. I'm like, this is cool. This is cool. Really, really cool. So it's something that, and apparently they've done some stuff too, some things with koala milk, that they said that there's similar peptides in koala bear milk. Look, what isn't awesome in Australia? Now, you can talk about the spiders in the
inland
States.
Inland taipans.
But seriously, it's
box
just...
box jellyfish.
Yeah, that's in the waters around Australia. That don't count. We're talking about on Australia. Okay. Australia is one of those places, that might be a place I could easily move. And they probably wouldn't have me. But, I mean, I would love to live in Australia.
I have a relative now that's living in Sydney.
We need to go visit Australia. You and I have talked about it. The families want to do it. We really need to go do it.
Let's do it.
But we need to go spend 2 weeks in Australia and then 2 weeks in England, over there in Europe and all that, because we got to make the rounds over there because I want to see that too. But, anyhow, I just thought it was cool that there's somebody taking the time to take their little fingers, milk. Little tiny Tasmanian devil. You imagine them growling.
Oh, man.
You're trying to milk them.
Yeah.
Can't get much milk out of that one.
That's a tough job.
All right.
Well, moving on. Check this out. Russian researchers find a secret Nazi-era Arctic weather station.
I love Russian researchers.
Right? It says a weather station on the island of Alexandra Land in the Arctic Circle is involved in a story concerning secret Nazi science projects and meteorologists poisoned by polar bear meat. The story is so strange, it's often dismissed as an odd wartime myth. But now, some 72 years later, almost like the Cubs, 71 years later, Russian researchers have stumbled upon the site of this lost weather station, along with a handful of wartime relics from the 1940s. A man named Yevgeny Ermolov, who's a senior researcher at the National Park, said in a statement, "Before, it was only known from written sources, but now we also have real proof. The station, known as the Fortune Seeker, or in German, Schatzengräber, was a secret Nazi-era meteorological station that was operated by Germany on the Franz Josef Land archipelago during the Second World War. It was reportedly abandoned and destroyed in July 1944. The story goes that all of the scientists on the island became severely ill with trichinosis after being forced to eat infected polar bear meat during a stint of low supplies. Now, the meteorologists were rescued, and the camp was thought to be actively destroyed. The following decades of harsh Arctic weather were also thought to have eroded what was left of the settlement. Now, among the artifacts they have discovered, Cam, on the island, are objects bearing, of course, Nazi insignias and swastikas. Most importantly for the researchers, many of the items also appear to be marked and dated to give further confirmation that this is the real deal. Now they hope to take these objects back to the mainland where they can be archived, studied, and eventually put on public display. So, pretty cool. There's this rumored Arctic, you know, Nazi base. They weren't sure what was going on there, and now they find it. Now, there's nothing there that indicates they were doing some top secret stuff with UFOs and anti-gravitic machines.
Drats.
Looked like they were just monitoring weather.
Yeah.
Basically. But it's a real thing. So they just found it, and it's like a time capsule because no one's been there since they got those scientists out of there that were dying from trichinosis. It's been left untouched because we're talking about a very small island, this archipelago. And it's up in the Arctic Circle. There's no real reason to hang out. I mean, it's frozen year-round.
That's true, yeah.
So why would anybody... I mean, of course, no one's going to stumble upon it, and they finally did. Pretty cool.
And eating bear meat is notorious for giving people trichinosis.
That's absolutely right.
If it's not fully
cooked.
Well,
you think about it, polar bears' diet only consists of meat.
Yeah.
And so they're eating rotting and putrid seals.
Something else that had trichinosis, and it passed it on, and now you got it. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty
cool. That'd be a horrible way to go, dying of trichinosis.
I've heard it's terrible. I've met one hunter one time that told me he caught it.
Mm-hmm. I knew a guy. I used to bow hunt with a guy that actually had trichinosis from the same thing. Wild pigs. Ended up getting it from wild hogs. I believe Steve Rinella from the Meat Eater podcast and the television show. Yeah, Steve Rinella got it from bear too. I believe.
I think he's had malaria. I think he's had just about everything. Right?
Yeah, you can't kill him. He's like a cockroach. That he just keeps coming back. Speaking of something wild, I got you something wild. Now this comes from Reddit, but it was also posted online. You can find some spots that's got this. Also, Lon talked about it on Phantoms and Monsters, folks. But there was some two men were out actually camping in the Michigan wilderness. And they say that they actually had an encounter with a possible Bigfoot. They were some self-described outdoorsmen, and this is what they had to say. Never really was big in the Bigfoot scene until last month out in the middle of the woods in Waterloo, Pinckney, for a small game backpacking trip with my buddy. Got there last night around 11:30 p.m. We set up our camp by about 12:30. Around 2 a.m. we wake up, and my buddy mentions to me about how cold it was. We hear footsteps around 20 to 25 feet away from us. We both are just laying still at this point, just to hear what's with us. The most loud, freakish, inhuman yell, scream, roar is shouted towards us twice before it took off fast from us with heavy, two-footed running. The only remotely close animal I've heard make this sound are mountain lions and cougars. The way it was running sounded two-footed, as opposed to four-legged gallop, and the sound of it crashing through the woods made us realize it was big. We joked about it being a Bigfoot. Then we saw how much he's seen in these parts of the woods, in Michigan. We think it must have seen us in the dark. We moved into the car for the night after this. Now, he goes back on to talk about this, folks. It says that both my friend and I are Marine Reserves and have been raised to be very avid outdoorsmen. My father and I are into bushcrafting and backpacking. My mom is into car camping, and my friend's parents are avid hunters, backpackers, and his mom was a DNR. We're no stranger to the woods and wildlife and have experienced a lot of nature and different animals and sounds that are part of our natural habitat in Michigan. This is unlike anything either of us have heard. Goes on to say that I'd say, and he's talking about the idea that it was running on 2 feet.
Right.
And the fact that he said it was definitely on there. And he says that I'd say that it was running fairly quickly because it was screaming as it was moving. And the screams moved pretty quickly, as well as the sounds of its foot impacting the ground, which also sounded like longer strides as the impact wasn't very close together. Probably about the same strides I'd take, maybe slightly longer, and I'm 6'2". As for where the screams were when we heard them, I couldn't tell you if they were high or low. They weren't ground level, but being between 5 and 7 feet above the ground. I couldn't give you any more specifics. It was so incredibly loud that it filled the forest.
Wow, that's creepy.
Well, and the coolest thing about the story is it always goes back, makes me start thinking of Survivor Man, Les Stroud, when he talks about that encounter that happened to him in Alaska.
Yeah.
And he said, look, man, I've camped in a lot of places around the world, in a lot of jungles and rainforests, and heard primates. And what I heard in Alaska was a primate. It
yeah.
made a primate sound. And what he talks about is this same thing. A loud walking. You could tell it was something loud coming in. The primate noise, and then it busted brush as it took off, and it's the same kind of fleeing the way it makes these sounds. So, look, I don't know how to feel about this. I'm sure you could, I guess, mistaken it for being a four-legged creature galloping, but also, like he says, it would make a different sound. It wouldn't sound the same as it was when two legs are running and moving through there. But what would you mistake for and he doesn't use the word primate, but what he's talking about is this yelling, screaming sound. It's he, you know, relates it close to a large cat, like a mountain lion sound
yeah.
or a cougar.
I don't know.
What would you try to mistake in that for? I mean, it doesn't really fit the mold of anything as we know it.
Yeah, but not without being there or hearing what he
yes.
heard. I can't make that call. Very scary. But if you think that's scary, check this out. Earth faces another ice age within 15 years as, once again, Russian scientists discover sun cooling. They say that experts say that solar activity, as low as it currently is, has not been seen since the mini ice age that took place between 1645 and 1715, a period known as the Maunder Minimum, where the entire Thames River froze over. It says a new model has allowed experts to predict solar activity with more accuracy than ever before, and it suggests that magnetic activity will fall by 60% between the years 2030 and 2040. The model looks at the sun's 11-year heartbeat, the period it takes for magnetic activity to fluctuate. This cycle was first discovered some 173 years ago. Now, dynamo effects are a geophysical theory that dictate how the movement of the Earth's outer core conducts materials like liquid iron across the magnetic field to create an electric current. This also influences fluid motion beneath the Earth's surface to create two magnetic fields along the axis of the Earth's rotation. Now, a woman named Valentina Zarkova from the Northumbria University applied this theory to the sun and was able to predict the effects of solar cycles within 97% accuracy. Ms. Zarkova said that the National Astronomy Meeting, we have found magnetic wave components appearing in pairs, originating in two different layers in the sun's interior. They both have a frequency of approximately 11 years. Although this frequency is slightly different, they are offset in time. Combining both waves together and comparing the real data for the current solar cycle, we found that our prediction showed an accuracy of 97%. Now, Ms. Zarkova also says the next cycle is set to peak in 2022, and after the cycle known as Cycle 26, will herald in a new ice age. They said in Cycle 26, the two waves exactly mirror each other, peaking at the same time but in opposite hemispheres of the sun. This interaction will be disruptive. They will nearly cancel each other out, and we predict this will lead to the properties of another Maunder Minimum. So, if their predictions are accurate, we could be heading for another ice age in 15 years. And, you know, they always talk about global warming, but global ice age is way worse. So, I don't know. I don't know if that's just doom porn or if this is real. But, God, I hope not.
Yeah, I don't want any more ice age. I'm good. I don't want it to be hot, don't get me wrong.
Right?
But I'd rather be warm than be real cold.
Yeah, well, let's take a break. And after the break, I'm going to be discussing something because Old Hallows Eve is about to be here. Halloween's coming up. So we're going to do something spooky, and I decided to do something with witches. We're going to be talking about the Salem witch trials. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice, and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Salem Witch Trials occurred in colonial Massachusetts between 1692 and 1693. More than 200 people were accused of practicing witchcraft or the devil's magic, and 20 were executed. Eventually, the colony admitted the trials were a mistake and compensated the families of those convicted. Since then, the story of the trials has become synonymous with paranoia and injustice, and it continues to be the subject of popular imagination more than 300 years later. To get to the bottom of this story, let's go back to the beginning. Several centuries ago, many practicing Christians, and those of other religions, had a strong belief that the devil could give certain people known as witches the power to harm others in return for their loyalty. A witchcraft craze rippled through Europe from the 1300s to the end of the 1600s. Tens of thousands of supposed witches, mostly women, were executed. Though the Salem trials came on just as the European craze was winding down, local circumstances explained their onset. In 1689, English rulers William and Mary started a war with France in the American colonies. Known as King William's War to colonists, it ravaged regions of upstate New York, Nova Scotia, and Quebec, sending refugees into the county of Essex and specifically Salem Village in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Salem Village is present-day Danvers, Massachusetts. Colonial Salem Town became what's now Salem. The displaced people created a strain on Salem's resources. This aggravated the existing rivalry between families with ties to wealth of the port of Salem and those who depended on agriculture. Controversy also brewed over Reverend Samuel Parris, who became Salem Village's first ordained minister back in 1689. He was disliked because of his rigid ways and his greedy nature. The Puritan villagers believed all the quarreling was the work of the devil. In January 1692, Reverend Parris's daughter, Elizabeth, age 9, and niece, Abigail Williams, age 11, and friend of the family, Ann Putnam, began secretly dabbling in fortune-telling techniques, specifically a technique known as Venus glass, during which the girls dropped egg whites into a glass of water and interpreted whatever shapes or symbols appeared in an attempt to learn more about their future husbands. According to the book, A Modest Inquiry into the Nature of Witchcraft by local minister Reverend John Hale, on one of those occasions, the girls became terrified when they saw the shape of a coffin in this glass. I knew one of the afflicted persons who, as I was credibly informed, did try with an egg and a glass to to find her future husband's calling. Till there came up a coffin, that is, a specter in a likeness of a coffin, and she was afterward followed with diabolical molestation to her death, and so died a single person. A just warning to others to take heed of the handling, the devil's weapons, lest they get a wound nearby. Another I was called to pray with, being under some fits and vexations of Satan. And upon examination, I found she had tried the same charm, and after her confession of it, and manifestation of repentance for it, and our prayers to God for her, she was speedily released from the bonds of Satan. Shortly after the alleged incident, in January of 1692, Betty Paris and Abigail Williams began having fits and seizures and displayed strange behavior, such as barking like dogs and complaining that invisible spirits were pinching them. A short time later, Ann Putnam started experiencing the same symptoms. At the end of February, a local doctor, who is believed to be Dr. Griggs, was called in to examine the girls. Now unable to find anything physically wrong with the girls, he suggested they were bewitched. Just a few days later, the girls named three women they believed were bewitching them: Tituba, Sarah Good, and Sarah Osborne. When the women were arrested and examined on March 1st, Tituba made a shocking confession that she was a witch and claimed there were other witches in Salem working closely with the devil. This confession confirmed the colonists' greatest fears that the devil had invaded the colony and sparked a mass hysteria and a massive witch hunt that quickly took over the town. All three women were brought before the local magistrates and interrogated for several days, starting on March 1st, 1692. Osborne claimed innocence, as did Good, but Tituba confessed, "The devil came to me and bid me serve him." She described elaborate images of black dogs, red cats, yellow birds, and a black man who wanted her to sign his book. She admitted that she signed the book and said there were several other witches looking to destroy the Puritans. All three women were put in jail. With the seed of paranoia now firmly planted, a stream of accusations soon followed for the next few months. Charges against Martha Corey, a loyal member of the church in Salem Village, greatly concerned the community. If she could be a witch, then anyone could. In March of 1692, Giles Corey insisted on attending one of the examinations at Nathaniel Ingersoll's tavern. Martha Corey, who had expressed skepticism about the existence of witches and even the devil to some of her neighbors, tried to stop him, and Giles told others about the incident. On March 12th, Ann Putnam reported that she had seen Martha's specter and two deacons of the church, Edward Putnam and Ezekiel Cheever, informed Martha of the report. On March 19th, a warrant was issued for Martha's arrest, claiming she had injured Ann Putnam, Sr., and that Ann Putnam, Jr., Mercy Lewis and Abigail Williams, and Elizabeth Hubbard. She was to be brought in on Monday the 21st to Nathaniel Ingersoll's tavern at 12. At the Sunday worship service on March 20th, in the middle of service at Salem Village Church, Abigail Williams interrupted the visiting minister, Reverend Deodat Lawson, claiming she saw Martha Corey's spirit separate from her body and sit on a beam holding a yellow bird. She claimed that the bird flew to Reverend Lawson's hat where he hung it. Martha said nothing in response. Martha Corey was arrested by the constable, Joseph Herrick, and examined the next day. Others were now claiming to be afflicted by Martha. There were so many spectators that the examination was moved to the church building instead. magistrates John Hathorne and Jonathan Corwin questioned her. She maintained her innocence, stating, "I never had to do with witchcraft since I was born. I am a gospel woman." She was accused of having a familiar, a bird. At one point in the interrogation, she was asked, "Do you not see these children and women are rational and sober as their neighbors when your hands are fastened?" The record shows that the bystanders were then seized with fits when she bit her lip. The afflicted girls were all in an uproar. On April 14th, Mercy Lewis claimed that Giles Corey had appeared to her as a specter and forced her to sign the devil's book. Now, Martha Corey maintained her innocence and accused the girls of lying. She stated her disbelief in witchcraft, but the display by the accusers of her supposed control of their movements convinced the judge of her guilt. Local magistrates also questioned Sarah Good's 4-year-old daughter, Dorothy, and her timid answers were construed as a confession. The questioning got more serious in April when Deputy Governor Thomas Danforth and his assistants attended hearings. Dozens of people from Salem and other Massachusetts villages were brought in for questioning. On May 27, 1692, Governor William Phipps ordered the establishment of a special court of oyer and terminer, or to hear and to decide, for Suffolk, Essex, and Middlesex counties. The first case brought to the special court was Bridget Bishop, an older woman known for her gossipy habits and promiscuity. When asked if she committed witchcraft, Bishop responded, "I am as innocent as the child unborn." The defense must not have been very convincing, though, because she was found guilty and on June 10th became the first person hanged on what was later called Gallows Hill. 5 days later, respected minister Cotton Mather wrote a letter imploring the court not to allow spectral evidence, testimony about dreams and visions. The court largely ignored this request, and 5 people were sentenced and hanged in July, 5 more in August, and 8 in September. On October 3rd, following in his son's footsteps, Increase Mather, then president of Harvard, denounced the use of spectral evidence. "It were better that 10 suspected witches should escape than one innocent person be condemned." Governor Phipps, in response to Mather's plea and his own wife being questioned for witchcraft, prohibited further arrests, released many accused witches, and dissolved the court of oyer and terminer on October 29th. Phipps replaced it with a superior court of judicature, which disallowed spectral evidence and only condemned 3 out of the 56 defendants. Phipps eventually pardoned all who were in prison on witchcraft charges by May 1693. Unfortunately, the damage had already been done. 19 were hanged on Gallows Hill. A 71-year-old man was pressed to death with heavy stones, and several people died in jail. And nearly 200 people overall had been accused of practicing the devil's magic. Following the trials and executions, many involved, like Judge Samuel Sewall, publicly confessed error and guilt. On January 14, 1697, the general court ordered a day of fasting and soul-searching for the tragedy of Salem. In 1702, the court declared the trials unlawful, and in 1711, the colony passed a bill restoring the rights and good names of those accused and granted £600 restitution to all their heirs. However, it was not until 1957, more than 250 years later, that Massachusetts apologized for the events of 1692. In the 20th century, artists and scientists alike continue to be fascinated by the Salem witch trials. Playwright Arthur Miller resurrected the tale with his 1953 play, The Crucible, using the trials as an allegory for McCarthyism paranoia in the 1950s. Additionally, numerous hypotheses have been devised to explain the strange behavior that occurred in Salem in 1692. One of the most concrete studies, published in Science magazine in 1976 by psychologist Linda Caporeal, blamed the abnormal habits of the accused on the fungus ergot, which can be found in rye, wheat, and other cereal grasses. Toxicologists say that eating ergot-contaminated foods can lead to muscle spasms, vomiting, delusions, and even hallucinations. Although the fungus thrives in warm and damp climates, not too unlike the swampy meadows in and around Salem Village, where rye was the staple grain during the spring and summer months. In August 1992, to mark the 300th anniversary of the trials, Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel dedicated the Witch Trials Memorial in Salem. Also in Salem, the Peabody Essex Museum houses the original court documents and the town's most visited attraction, the Salem Witch Museum. All in all, the Salem witch trials of 1692 up into 1693 caused the death of 20 women who were executed, and five others died in a lonely jail cell. So, were there really witches in and around Salem area in 1692 to 1693? Or was it the result of paranoia, eventually leading neighbors to turn on each other for selfish reasons? Many historians have suggested that the Putnam family were using the witchcraft hysteria as an excuse to seek their revenge against residents of Salem that they disapproved of. Thomas and Edward Putnam filed the most of these complaints against the accused themselves, on behalf of the afflicted girls who were too young to legally do so. Also, a recent handwriting analysis conducted by Professor Peter Grund from the University of Kansas determined that over 100 of the Salem witch trial court documents were written by Thomas Putnam himself. These documents include the depositions of the afflicted girls, which, coincidentally, share very similar language and phrases. For example, many of these depositions state the afflicted girls were grievously afflicted or grievously tormented, and they describe how the girls believe in my heart that the accused is a witch. These same depositions also frequently refer to the accused as dreadful witches and dreadful wizards. This suggests that the afflicted girls' recorded testimonies may have been altered and tampered with by Thomas Putnam, who often served as a court clerk during these trials, indicating that he may have had an even bigger influence on the trials than previously thought. In addition, a book titled The Salem Story, Reading the Witch Trials of 1692, speculates that one of the reasons Ann Putnam Jr. may have gotten involved with the witch trials in the first place is because the Putnam children were being abused by their parents, and Ann was directing her anger over the abuse at others around her. One such victim of Ann Jr.'s misplaced anger was her neighbor, Rebecca Nurse. Ann was particularly active in the case against Nurse. It is believed that Rebecca Nurse was targeted by the Putnam family due to a decades-long rivalry between her family and the Putnams. This first began with a battle for land with Rebecca's father in Topsfield, and continued with disputes about the boundary between Rebecca and Thomas Putnam's adjoining property in Salem Village. In addition, the Nurse family also disapproved of the newly appointed minister of Salem Village, Reverend Samuel Parris, whom was one of the Putnam family's biggest supporters. As a result, it was no surprise that the Putnams were the ones to accuse Nurse of witchcraft when the witch hunt finally began. Ann Putnam Jr., her mother Ann Putnam Sr., and Abigail Williams were Nurse's main accusers, and it was their accusations that led to Nurse's arrest on March 24th. Ann Jr. also testified that she witnessed Nurse attacking her mother at their home on March 18th of that year. Ann Jr. and her mother were not the only Putnams to testify against Rebecca Nurse. Most of the witnesses who did testify against her, including Abigail Williams, Edward Putnam, Thomas Putnam, John Putnam Jr., Hannah Putnam, Samuel Paris, Henry McKinney, Mary Walcott, and Elizabeth Hubbard were either Putnam family members or friends of the family. Nurse denied all of her accusations and was actually found not guilty at the end of her trial in June 1692. However, upon reading the verdict in the courtroom, the afflicted girls began to suffer fits, and Chief Justice William Staunton asked the jury to reconsider their decision. The jury briefly deliberated and then came back with a guilty verdict. Nurse was sentenced to death and was hanged at Gallows Hill on July 19th, 1692. Whether or not some of these accused women were really witches or not, doesn't seem to matter. Most, if not all, were completely innocent of their charges, but were killed all the same. To me, the most terrifying part of the story is how easily people are willing to turn on each other, whether it's for differences in race, social status, religious beliefs, or basic life choices. It seems that some people of that time period were just as judgmental of their peers as we are today.
And so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Interesting case, interesting story. I think what's most disturbing is, like I mentioned, the fact that it looked like it was mass hysteria, that none of these women were really creating any witchcraft, and it was perhaps just people who didn't like somebody else in their town or village, and they were making up these stories that to basically get rid of people. And then other people started claiming similar things. They think that this ergot fungus was in some of the food, the wheat, and people were, you know, eating that, and that's what was causing them to act crazy, have hallucinations, vomit. No one was actually controlling anybody with witchcraft. And, you know, it cost the death of like 25 people. And even now, the Massachusetts government has come forward and saying that they apologize for all that stuff that they did. I don't know. It's a tragedy. It's a terrifying story. It's really terrifying and showing. It shines a spotlight on human nature.
Yes.
How you can get a couple people to start this going, and other people will begin to turn. I think we see it even in modern day. Like somebody truly witnesses the police do something that's inappropriate. Okay, and then shortly afterwards, there's several other groups start claiming similar things, and then as it gets out, you're like, well, I don't know. You know what I mean?
You can be easily lost.
You start wondering, is every account really happening the way they're telling it, or is it because of one case? People are stretching the truth for whatever reason. I don't know. It's a terrifying story. What do you think about those Salem witch trials?
First of all, it is a terrifying thing for me to think about being not just falsely accused of something, but falsely accused of something like this for what they're going to do to you.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess the thing that always makes me question these stories like this is I would like to know what they left out. There's a lot of stuff that went on. I mean, even what we get when the way we get these explanations now, think of the things that were left out of the stories because they still didn't. You know, they explained themselves. They knew they were wrong later, you know, or whatever it was. But think of the stuff that was left out of what happened. Because I do know this. I do know that you're talking about, whenever you're talking about the Salem witch trials here in the States, 1692. That's what we're talking about.
Right.
1 year, 92, 93, what we're talking about. But they were 300 years of it in Europe. From the 1300s, basically, to the end of the 1600s, there were 300 years of this same thing. They believed that there were tens of thousands of mostly women killed.
I read that there was closer to 50,000, they think, were killed. Well, that's another thing that's it's contrary to popular belief. None of the condemned people in the Salem witch trials were actually burned at the stake. They say in accordance with English Law 19, all the victims of the Salem witch trials were either hung at the Gallows Hill, and one elderly gentleman who refused to plea innocence or guilty was pressed to death with heavy stones.
Oh, gosh.
But now in Europe, like you're mentioning, there were lots of people that were burned at the stake.
Yes.
But so witch burning is a real thing. That just didn't take place in New England.
Well, and it starts making you look at the fact, was there religious strife? Was it a power play? Were there people that I don't really, you know, I want to do this or I want to do that, and it doesn't fall in accordance with religion, and now we're going to try to twist it to try to come after you? Because we see that today. We see that with problems with some of the religions in the world now, the way things are getting twisted, and then some people take it. And you can look at history and look at what's going on now, and a lot of this stuff happens if you just replace the name, the word witches, with something else, where you can plug somebody else in there, a whole nother group or a whole nother belief system or a whole nother culture or a whole nother race plugged in there with the same thing, where people are going after them. This kind of stuff always makes me... Have you ever seen the movie Goya's Ghosts?
No.
I caught it by total accident one time, and it actually, what's his name? Shug from No Country from Old Men. Javier Bardem. Javier Bardem and Natalie Portman are in it. And from what I can remember, and of course, y'all don't butcher me for this because it's been a while, but what I can is Goya is a painter, and I believe that's a Skarsgård, the guy that's the painter that's doing the paintings. But anyway, Natalie Portman is one of his muses, if you will, that he likes to paint, and Javier falls kind of in love with her, and you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff with it, but I guess maybe she turns him down, I can't remember, but he tortures Natalie Portman, and for being Jewish, spreading Jewish rituals in a Christian or a Catholic belief system is what it is. And you can see how fast it gets out of control. You can see how it goes from one thing to where it just boom, and it's crazy because it takes place in the end of the 1792, 1795, somewhere around, right around in there, in Spain is where this is taking place.
Okay.
So the story, that was one thing about the movie when I came across it, started watching it, was I was like, it stuck with me, the idea of seeing that with the Salem witch trials, is I'm like, this is how these things, but it's not new. I mean, just the whole idea, but people being persecuted as witches and then done the way they were, I can't imagine having a daughter and then them claiming that your daughter does that. And you're like, my daughter's just a little girl.
Right.
You know, she's 11 years old. Now y'all are going to take her and hang her, you know, because you think she's doing some kind of witchcraft, or who knows? Or like you said, what if it was some sort of disease or some sort of infection or something that's caused them to do something crazy? So I don't know, man. It drives me nuts to see stuff like that.
Yeah, man.
And it's a terrible
story. It is.
Story.
It's a tragedy, right?
Yes.
But before we get out of here, I'd like to mention our sponsor, Gaia.com. Mm-hmm. You should check that out. You should go over there. I'll put links to it in the show notes. This is a pretty cool service. It's much like Hulu or Netflix or something. It's a website. You go to it, and they have thousands, over 7,000 videos in different sections that you can watch and stream from anywhere. There's sections like My Yoga, Health and Longevity, Seeking the Truth, Spiritual Growth, Films, and stuff like that. And the Seeking the Truth category is actually my favorite so far. I went over there, and I've been recently watching Deep Space, which is an ongoing series. I told you on the other show that it's kind of like Ancient Aliens, but a little better. And there's this new documentary I just watched over there called The Secret, Evidence That We Are Not Alone. And it was pretty interesting. Check this out.
Almost 60 years after Roswell, the mystery of what crashed in the deserts of New Mexico remains a secret. The government's official stance about the existence of UFOs has always been denial. Eyewitnesses have come and gone. Project Blue Book, the UFO study program of the U.S. Air Force, has gone out of business. But many questions remain. Researchers and private investigators continue to follow every lead in hopes that someday the truth will be revealed. Newly leaked classified government documents may be the first real evidence to shed light on this never-ending story.
So there you go. Pretty cool. I suggest anyone interested to go over there and listen to that. And watch that. It's pretty cool. There's a lot of other cool shows on there that I'm waiting to watch. UFOs and Nukes. There's one over there with David Icke called Dot Connector, which is unveiling the web of power. Jose Escamilla's got a film over there called Luna, which is more of these, you know, moon bases on the moon that are being photographed by amateur astronomers. Now, look, I'm not an astronomer, so I can't say.
You're definitely an amateur, though.
Definitely. I can't say what these pictures are, but I haven't watched the film yet either. But from the preview and the trailer, it looks pretty interesting. So I'm going to be checking that out. I suggest if you're into that kind of stuff, if you're into secret space programs and things like that, and you like to watch documentaries, go over there to Gaia.com, man. It's pretty neat. What do you think?
Well, I agree with you because I got away from even the Seeking the Truth, found more stuff on it. I got to digging into it because, you know, you and I both like bulletproof coffee. You like to mix it all up. Uh-huh. And the first place I've heard about it was Dave Asprey, right?
Yes, sir.
When he was on Joe Rogan. There is a documentary on here called The Hidden Power of Coffee with Dave Asprey. And I watched it, and it's great. It's a cool show.
Really?
Yeah, it's not even an hour. It's not quite a full hour. But it just, it talks about, you know, how it curbs your cravings, how it gives you energy. But it's really neat how it goes into with, like, health and everything. So that's another thing that I appreciate. I can watch something about ancient alien, ancient moon base. I watch wild stuff that I enjoy. And then I can watch health stuff the same way. If you're like us and you're sick and tired or you burn through a bunch of stuff documentary-wise or fun-wise on Netflix, dude, this is worth it. It's
dude,
worth it.
Because I did
it's,
that.
Yeah.
I mean, years ago when Netflix first came out, I was in heaven, right? I was in documentary heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And I would watch everything. But then now that I've completely caught up, like every time there's a new documentary out, I watch it. And sometimes it's on stuff that I'm not even really interested in. That I kind of like. The other day I watched a guy trying to reclaim the world record in some like 1980s video game. And I was like,
I think I've seen that. But is that where he's playing Donkey Kong?
It wasn't Donkey Kong, though. It was, I don't remember the name of it. It was like a snake. It was like a,
I think I've seen
it. I don't remember what it was called.
Yeah.
Anyways, so completely ridiculous, but there's nothing on TV.
Yeah.
I don't even have TV. And so I start watching these documentaries, and like literally in like 15, 20 minutes, I start becoming interested in this guy's story. I'm like, hey, I didn't think that was for me, but I ended up liking it. Now, I've also seen some real horrible documentaries. I'm just like, man, these are garbage. But very cool service if you're interested in that kind of thing. I would do it. Yes, sir.
I have got one thing before we get out of here.
Sure.
A quick shout out to our good friend and our training partner, Miss Dakota Ronaldo. Dakota himself is going to be competing in Fight to Win Pro 17. Now, I talked about Dylan a few weeks ago. Dylan went out there and got the knockout in his MMA fight. I forgot what Dakota's MMA record is. It's good. But Dakota's actually fighting in a jiu-jitsu tournament called Fight to Win Pro, where it's done a lot like the Metamoris and the EBIs and all the submission only. But I don't know that it has the EBI rules. But anyhow, this is actually going to take place over in North Richland Hills in the DFW area. But it's going to be on October 29th. You can watch it on flowgrappling.com. You can probably go buy tickets for it, the whole thing. If you decide to buy tickets for it, make sure you put Dakota's name down, whatever. But anyhow, Dakota, good luck, my friend, and we will be watching, and I hope you go out there and get the sub.
Right,
that's what I'm going for, the sub.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to the World Series this week.
Yes.
And outside of that, me and Jacob, we have two more baseball games before our season's over as well. We're still have only lost one game, so let's hopefully we'll finish these last two out. I hope everybody out there has a really good work week. And for you elite members, we'll be speaking again on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you next Monday. For Pretty Lights, Inner Traditions, New Page Books, Llewellyn Books, Anomalous Books, Ancient American Magazine, and Gaia.com, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Kim Hale.
Peace, y'all.
I am your automatic lover.